Blog Talk Radio.
This is Robert Greeno. This is Robert Greeno. General Quarters. General Quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good afternoon, everybody. I hope most folks are having a good Sunday afternoon. Welcome to a free-for-all edition of Midrats. You've got that right. We do not have a guest. It's just Eagle One and myself sitting on the front porch talk about the news of the day, and also if there's anything that somebody in the chat room, or if they're not feeling telephone shy and they're willing to throw in a couple of shekels for a long distance phone call, want to call in and ask a question either about a topic or there's a specific thing you would really like to have Eagle One or myself answer for you. Of course, this is live radio, so you won't be screened. We'll just tee the ball up for you and let you take a swack at it. You can call in if you'd like. It's area code 347-308-8397. And for our friends in Turkey, yes, I know you're out here. That's country code 1, as it should be, 347-308-8397. And now let's get right to it. Eagle One, how are you doing this Sunday?
I'm doing well. What kind of exciting topics do you have to bring to the table today there, so
Take out the potpourri dish and see what petal hopped to the front. Well, I think one of the things that was neat today, really this weekend, is here we are well over a decade into this war, and we actually have a movie that people in uniform actually got a little bit jazzed about. Of course, Act of Valor came out this weekend, and Eagle One, we're different generations here, and you've got a little more depth and perspective on this topic. But it's been a big frustration of mine, and I've blogged about it over my home blog a little bit, the fact that I know there's a halfway decent screenplay that's been purchased, and there's actually been some pre-production done years ago about the Battle of Fallujah. I read somewhere where they were trying to get Harrison Ford to play General Mattis. That would be interesting in a couple of ways. We also know that Horse Soldiers is in pre-production, but they never seem to go anywhere. And at least if you throw a dart at the wall, when you some people define Vietnam as 58, I guess really 65 is when it really broke above the background noise for a lot of people. But at least, you know, with a nice dollop of Velveeta cheese, at least there was the Green Berets that came in, was that 67 or 68?
Yeah, it was a long time ago, whenever it was.
Yeah, but it was just a few years in that conflict, but we're going this far in, and we've yet to have any type. There have been a couple of political films made, which surprisingly stopped being put out there after 2008. I wonder why. But
the Green Berets was viewed by many people as a political movie because it was John Wayne's answer to the Vietnam War critics. And David Jansen, who played the reporter in that, was supposed to represent the doubting Americans who didn't understand what we were doing there. Well, I was going to say, there have been some Vietnam War movies. I think between the Green Berets and probably when we were soldiers once and young, I don't remember too many that portrayed Vietnam veterans Vietnam participants in a particularly positive light.
No, I think you're exactly right there. And I remember one of the comments that was made by more than one person. I consider it a Vietnam movie. A lot of people may not, but Forrest Gump, there was a lot of undercurrents and sub-stories in Forrest Gump I think that worst case you could say was objective to those that served in Vietnam, but I thought actually was kind of a nod, almost an apology in some respects, from to put a little bit of a positive light on the Vietnam generation. And but you're right. I think you can count the John Wayne's hunk of Velveeta is a political from the other side of the spectrum. Forrest Gump, a quasi-accidental nod. But yeah, besides Mel Gibson's one movie, the Vietnam generation has mostly been the subject, and it still is a subject, of smears, slights, alternative history, and anybody who has grown up with or around people who have served in Vietnam can rapidly see that what is the popular image, popular being those that have an associated with the military, and the actual image of what somebody was and is who served in Vietnam are radically different.
Yeah, I think that the book that you frequently reference, which, the Stolen Valor book kind of points out the misperceptions created by Hollywood of what the typical Vietnam veteran was like. And according to those movies, the veterans are all drug addicted, ruthless, snap at any minute and kill everyone in the post office types. As the book points out, most Vietnam veterans are quite normal and have gone on to quite successful lives. So it's the contrast between the two, and then they keep trying to bring that up in later movies. The early war movies about Iraq and Afghanistan wanted to play to that stereotype too, decent young men were taken and corrupted by an evil system and turned into ruthless gun-toting fiends.
I think and the great thing about B.G. Burkitt, and I'm forgetting his co-author of the book, is the fact that it was written before 9/11, and it was written far enough after the Vietnam. I think it was written in the mid to late 90s, actually. And it does a great service because it's very fact-heavy. And I think it's what he did pre-internet is pretty darn amazing. And it would have been somebody who took under his wing the responsibility that he did in today's era would definitely pass the news a lot faster. And I've been recommending that book for years. One, because it's pre-9/11, but also the fact that it is so fact-heavy that if somebody walked away thinking that everybody was the deer hunter or Rambo on Thorazine, that they would walk away hopefully mad, mad at the lies that they had absorbed. And I remember I picked up the book I was at EPMAC. So wandering around for a meeting at EPMAC probably around 2003, wandering through a used bookstore in New Orleans, and I picked it up for like $5 or $6. I think one of the great things is if you go on Amazon right now, you'd be lucky if you picked up a used copy for $15 to $20. So I think that there's a greater interest in that. And going back to the movie at question, though, Act of Valor, I haven't seen it, and I would throw it out to our listenership or those in the chat room as if anybody has seen it, I would love for them to call in at 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. And give us your on-the-site review. And if somebody wants to get a review written as only a properly testosterone-laden junior officer can give, I have a guest post up at my home blog that outlines the hot chick, ugly chick, fat chick theory of movie making, which actually I think works out pretty good here. But let me ask you this question, Eagle One. I was pondering this as I was starting up the computer. About Act of Valor, is after Bin Laden assumed room temperature, I kind of got my little panties in a wad and was upset because I thought that the the Navy Special Warfare community was missing an opportunity here to get their story out. And boy, you thought I would have gone WikiLeaks on everybody with documents that nobody's supposed to see until the 22nd century. A lot of gnashing of teeth, rending of clothes about we can't talk about SEALs and what they may or may not do. They're, you know, everything and their mother. I went, this is ridiculous. This is, you know, 2011 back then, and news is going to get out, and you might as well get ahead of the story and use it for what it's worth, because you're not going to be able to keep anything a secret. It's not already a secret. And here we have the SEALs, actually real SEALs, real ammo, real TTPs, modified, I'm sure, out there in public. What is your take about, I think, the people who decided to lean in and help make this movie? Somebody needs to buy them a new car, or at least a gold watch. I think it's a huge coup. Kind of raise a profile to a certain extent. What are your thoughts about them kind of coming out of the closet and pushing this to the front?
Well, I have been surprised with how forthcoming they've been, but I was not surprised to see the other day that I think the head of SOCOM, Special Operations Command, said, SOCOM, whatever his name is, said, maybe we're talking too much. You know, we're revealing some things we don't need to reveal. And I think there's going to be an effort, probably after this movie, to put as much back into the bag as they can for a while. I mean, some of the stories are going to come out no matter what. But, you know, they're getting all the publicity they need. Every young kid you meet now wants to be, many of them want to be SEALs. And if they can't be SEALs, of course, they still want to fly Navy aircraft and all that. Somebody asked about the name of the book. The name of the book is Stolen Valor. It's by B.G. Burkett and Glenna Whitley. It's an older book, but it details a lot of the wrongs done to the Vietnam-era veterans. And while we're talking about that, and before we get to some of the other topics that are being thrown up on the chat room, we should note that the Supreme Court has taken the Stolen Valor Act and is should be engaging in making a decision on that fairly soon. As you may know, the Stolen Valor Act takes people to task who put on uniforms and pretend to be something they're not. The fake Medal of Winter Honor, the fake Green Beret, the fake Navy SEAL, all those people, many of these fakes have done nothing in their lives except, I guess, go to hardware stores and pick up bits and pieces of uniforms and put them on. And this act is, it's going to be an interesting test to see whether, as some people argue, that what they're engaging in is simply a lie and therefore covered by free speech, or whether it is a violation because they're trying to gain some benefit by being a veteran.
Well, let me ask you this, Counselor. I have found that argument that lying is a way of free speech in this respect. I thought that a rather weak argument, but it seems to be getting traction. And here's why I think it's kind of weak, is you do get, and a lot of these guys have been busted because they've gotten free hunts from Wounded Warrior. I don't think the actual Wounded Warrior program, but there are other parallel programs like that. They've gotten free dinners, party invitations, the unsolicited affection of the opposite sex, or even the same sex in the case out in Texas. And also, if you're allowed to dress up and pretend to be somebody that you're not in order to accrue the goodwill towards that position, I don't know how well it would go inside the courtroom, Eagle One, but what's to stop somebody to act and pretend that they're a judge, to pretend and act that they're a state's attorney, to pretend that they are a city councilman, and to not be held accountable to that because, hey, I just think it's cool to call myself judge and to walk around with a black, whatever they call it, robe. Is there a connection between the two? Do you see that being a strong enough argument, or is that just the only ring they have to grab hold of?
Yeah, I think that you know, if a person took up a gavel and went into a local courtroom and sat down and began trying to hear cases, You know, they might get in some serious trouble, but otherwise I think the judges say, well, the guy puts on a robe and goes to a party, which you hardly ever see, by the way. You know, goes to a party and says, yes, I'm Judge so-and-so, and I'm, you know, the gain for that is minimal. Most people don't respect judges, lawyers, or...
Good point.
Or
a congressman.
Or a congressman enough to really make a big deal out of it. But there is something about putting on the uniform and putting on that blue medal with a little stars on it, little blue ribbon with little stars on it, that gets and commands a certain degree of respect. And that is whatever they get out of that. You know, whether there is some kind of financial gain or it's just the free beer and all that, they are getting some out of that. And if you commit a fraud in any other venue where you really intentionally mislead people into believing something is true and you gain a benefit, that is fraud, and that is, at least in the civil court world, punishable by, you know, loss. You know, you can sue people and get back what they took from you plus various penalties. So I think to the extent that the lies are what you would call harmless, you know, a movie actor dressing up on a movie set, that's one thing. A guy who goes to a party and attempts to inveigle young people of his or her opposite or the same gender into doing things they wouldn't otherwise do because he was a useless loser, but you know, they do engage because he's wearing the uniform. That ought to be punishable, in my view, and we'll see how the Supreme Court views it.
Yeah, I think one way or another. Actually, I think one way, if the Supreme Court says that it's okay for people to impersonate a military officer like that, or, you know, enlisted guy or whatever the routine is, I think there is a little bit of cosmic justice out there. At least we're in the internet era, and there are already plenty of sites up there. If you can't hold them legally accountable, you can always use two of my great motivators, fear and shame. However, I guess a good attorney could mau-mau somebody to not have one of those pages up there if you brought shame and discredit onto somebody. I don't know if you're allowed to lie and then nobody's allowed to call you on that lie. Do you think somebody would potentially, if the Supreme Court says it's okay for them to do that, and you had one of these... You know, there are a few places out there, especially for Medal of Honor winners and SEALs, that will hold people to task for faking it. Would those people be potentially liable for outing those people as fakes?
No, you're only liable if it's false. And I think you, Elaine, I know I have. I've put pictures and names of some of these slime ball pretenders. You know, and it's usually some kid who's 26 years old who's putting on a full colonel's uniform in the Marines you know, with a chest full of ribbons he couldn't have won. A lot of them dating from World War II and maybe even the Spanish-American War. And he walks around pretending that he's some, you know, and he's got some story that he's on a super secret mission and nobody can know about it. And he can't even talk about what he did to earn all those medals or why he's in such advanced rank. And if he's smart, he limps a little bit too, you know. So, I'm not going to give anybody else legal advice here, and I've warned about this on my own website, but I will say that I have no problem personally. If the evidence is so clear that guy, in my mind, is so clear, I have a reasonable belief that the guy is a fake, I don't have any problem putting his picture and name up on my website. And if he wants to come after me, then he's going to have to prove, despite all the super secret details which are hidden in some magic vault in Area 51, that what he said is true, and I'm willing to take that chance. I'm willing to bet. You know, if anybody wants to send me pictures of fakes and you think that it's and the information on them, I'll be happy to take a look at it. And if I have a reasonable belief that I'm looking at something fake, you'll see it on my website. I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah, I think it's a great crowdsourcing mechanism, too. I know we had a fair bit of, I wouldn't call it fun, but I think justice might be the phrase for in a really egregious case back in late 2010. But those little guys usually show up, usually when they're stress testing a button on a uniform they're wearing up on stage, and you're looking at them like, I don't think so. And what's kind of sad about it is trying to recapture some of my taxes. I've been using a lot recently the public library in my town that has a pretty extensive audiobook collection that you can check out. And I will listen to an audiobook. And I stumbled onto a book I didn't even know about. They must not have been a very good movie. They made a movie out of it called Rescue Dawn, actually starring Christian Bale. But it's a book called Hero Found, The Greatest POW Escape of the Vietnam War. And you had this guy, Dingler, Dirk Dingler, who's actually a German national who came over here when he was 18, got Shanghai'd by an Air Force recruiter to enlist in the Air Force so he could fly. And no, he actually just didn't do that for 4 years. He was just a E-133, then got out, but then he went to college because all he wanted to do was fly. And he was shot down over Laos in his A-1 and was an escapee. And you have people like Dieter Dingler. And the book is by Bruce Henderson. The book's called Hero Found, if anybody wants to look it up. It's a really good audio book. I'm about a third of the way, half of the way through it right now. You have legitimate people out there, the legitimate stories. And I think that's where a lot of the feelings that people have about the Stolen Valor Act bring up a fair bit of emotion. If the Supreme Court says it's legal to lie like that, I think there'll be all sorts of gnashing of teeth and rending of clothes on the military side of the house. But I think if the Supreme Court lets the Stolen Valor Act stand, you probably won't hear much rumbling from the other side, because I haven't seen a lot of the free speech people really support it as much. Maybe I'm missing it.
Yeah, I think that there's an effort out there by that group. I mean, they don't want the military to get any honor anyway. And so the fact that some guy dresses up, as a war hero, it doesn't faze them in the slightest. And you know, we have politicians who allegedly have done the same thing. There's a senator from Iowa who claims that he flew combat missions over Vietnam, and there have been a number of efforts to disprove it, and you know, he seems to get away with it. There certainly was the Swift boat effort about Senator Kerry. And although it's Senator Kerry did serve and did serve on the boats in the riverine forest, the allegations were that his service wasn't quite what he pretended it to be. You know, that is a much closer case. I know a lot of those guys who served with him, and I trust them immensely. And I don't know him very well, but you know, people do make inflated claims, and anybody who's ever read anybody else's resume looking to hire somebody knows that people make inflated claims. And I personally, since I dug the Grand Canyon, I haven't done much in the way of engineering work. But
we have BJ in the chat room, and I'm sure if we read his last fit rep or two, there'd probably be a couple of exaggerated things in there. But there are mine as well. I was explaining to a civilian friend of mine. Was asking about, you must get really honest appraisals in the military, and you must really be able to have faith in yourself so you don't get depressed. I started laughing. And she's like, "What are you laughing about?" I was like, "No, you don't understand the military fit rep system. You could be a drunk driving guy who wears a tutu to work, and you'll read like you're the second coming of George Patton."
Yeah, I just had a discussion with a human resources person. We were doing some Red Cross training together, and we were talking about the evaluations that Red Cross workers get after events. And we were both laughing about how meaningless they were, because nobody, you know, hardly ever do you see an honest evaluation of anyone, whether it's in the civilian world or in the military. And she said, well, you know, how people were talking about the most valuable feedback they ever got. And I said, you know, for me, and I'm sure for most people in the service, it's when your boss, whether your ship CO or whatever, turns to you and says, okay, you got it. And, you know, he's going to go to bed or whatever, and you're driving the ship, and you've got 200 or 300 or more people's lives and you're responsible for it. That is positive feedback. And a lot of people go through lives without ever getting that, and you won't see that very often in the civilian world. And I'm not sure if civilians understand what that means when somebody says, "Yeah, I was a command pilot, or I was a OOD, or a senior watch officer. What's the other one? Command duty officer at sea." But let's get on to some other topics. I think we've got some good stuff here. How about I want to ask you a question about the maritime patrol aircraft world. Where in the world is the Poseidon P-8 Alpha? Has this got a longer gestation period than an elephant?
Well, I think everything is actually flowing right on the timeline that it's supposed to be. Now, if I read the 2013 budget right, they've cut 10 off they've given it a haircut of 10 units. There are a couple things about the program that is kind of bubbling around in the background. A lot of people aren't familiar with the fact, you heard me say before, we're just 5 to 10 years behind the Europeans and the Brits with our budgetary crunch. But a few years ago, as a budgetary savings, the Royal Air Force got rid of all of their maritime patrol aircraft, their Nimrods. They only had a couple of dozen, I believe, both their normal version and their electronic version, as a cost-saving measure. They said, well, maybe we'll reconstitute it later. We'll take the risk and just nuked it. And there's always a threat when you're – the ASICS community will appreciate this – when you're transitioning from an older platform to a newer platform in a declining defense budget environment, that can become low-hanging fruit and could potentially be – chopped or gotten rid of wholesale. So I think the loss of 10 was predictable. Just like I think a couple years ago, I put out a post about the replacement for the ballistic missile submarine, and I was feeling pessimistic. I said, you're lucky if you get 10. I think actually we're lucky to get 6 to 8 when it's all said and done. It's better to take a haircut than to have it go all the way away. And they're hoping that the Broad Area Maritime Surveillance, the BAMS UAV, which is, it's funny reading some of the hype about it, it's just a Global Hawk. It's a Global Hawk with a different kit attached to it that will give the capability of not only being controlled from shore installations like you have with the normal Global Hawk, but you could also have, it would be interesting to see how this works out, local control by a P-8, and I think they're actually going to modify a couple of P-3s as well to do it if they haven't already, just to validate the system. But all the BAMS is going to do for you as a Global Hawk is you can talk to any P-3 Bubba, and they do some incredibly boring work for 8 to 10 hours at a time. Global Hawk can do that. We're talking your basic open ocean surveillance, tracking of merchant ships, of things of that manner. Global Hawk can fill that gap. I'm sure there are some secret squirrel stuff going on because you don't have too much payload capacity in the BAMS, but I'm sure you could put some neat electronic stuff in there to do. So it'll take some of those missions. So you combine the BAMS, and it'll be a few years of operations before you can actually see the utility of it. They're not going to see much personnel savings. There was a really great article about it. I actually have it in draft. I just haven't posted on it. When you look at the maintenance and the tail that follows Global Hawk, you're not saving much in personnel, really. And there's a lot of missions it cannot do, a lot of places it cannot go. You have the loss rate. But it will give the maritime patrol and reconnaissance community a little more to do with the P-8 than they can with the P-3. I had a very frustrated, she just left. I ran into her when I was nosing around the washer and dryer section at the exchange. Typical retiree. I've only been retired 2 years, and I'm already nudging around them looking for deals. But she
taking up space in exchange.
Exactly. I don't do it too often, but I'm chatty Cathy. I'll talk to anybody. But I was talking to her a bit. She was just finishing up her department head tour and was heading up to a shore duty job in D.C. And there's a couple of growing pains with the P-8. But she says the one frustrating thing for her and for a few other people was that the same argument keeps coming up where they said, why did they go with the 737 platform? You're just giving these pilots a type rating and they're all going to leave. And she had a very good point. It's something I completely agree with. It's like, no, you know, people are going to leave or leave anyway, whether they have a 737 type rating or not. You're more likely, I think, to keep good officers, whether they're pilots, whether they're sub-drivers, whether they're, you know, surface warfare officers. If they have a good piece of kit where when the toggle switch goes to on, the little lights illuminate and you can do your mission, you can do the job that you need to do. When you're primary, backup, and ready spare, you always go to the ready spare because the primary is broken, the backup is CAS rep, so all you're using is your ready spare. If you have good kit, if you have quality kit, you're going to keep your quality people. The people, not that people that leave are not quality, but people that are set to go are going to go. But she's real excited, even though they've got some of their mission systems needs to be tweaked, but that's expected. I thought it was also, you know, speaking of the Brits, they also leveraged some of the work that the Brits did for their replacement of the Nimrod. So they were inside the tube, which was good development cost. But barring something that somebody in the program office is hiding really tightly from, you know, she was sharp department heads and fleet duties, I think everybody will be pleasantly surprised at the program when you consider some of the other programs that I have trouble with, probably online with the F-18G. That program has seemed to roll out pretty good, but it was based off the Super Hornet, and a lot of the G-Wiz stuff they put on it was evolutionary or brought right over from the later models of the Prowler. So I think that's working pretty good on the aviation side of the house.
Well, speaking of evolutionary things, let's talk about something that wasn't evolutionary, the Littoral Combat Ship. I saw the other day that the Navy budget hearing, the CNO and the SECNAV were both getting pounded by some members of the panel. Representative Randy Forbes from Virginia, chairman of the Readiness Subcommittee, was more colorful in his call for more ships. Quote, "Why aren't you pounding the table asking for more ships?" He said, pounding the table. So, the argument is we've got a bunch of ships being built. Our friend Bob Work has argued that these replace everything from the paper towels in the men's restroom to the FFG. And where are we with this? And what is, I hate to keep beating the LCS to death, but I heard the other day that we're going to build whatever it is, 50 of them. Let's say we're going to build 50, but we're only going to have 65 modules. Is that right? What in the world are we doing?
Well, and I want to start off with this. First of all, I get this feeling, the same feeling. Remember, there was a long time back in 2009. I just quit posting on LCS because I was just sick. And then finally, I came up with a post. Oh, the gift that keeps on giving. And I still don't hit it as much as I want to. But it's important, Eagle One, I think, that we need to keep this going because this is going to be such a huge part of the fleet, and a huge bet has been made. You know, it would be one thing if this was 10% of the fleet. But when all is said and done, when we get up to the end of the terrible 20s, this potentially could be 25% of your fleet, 20% of your fleet. If you have a platform that is so suboptimal and that's such a large percentage of your fleet, it's going to be asked to, and you know this in from what ships were asked to do in Vietnam, it's going to be asked to do things that it wasn't designed to do. And they're already talking about that. Well, you know, it can help escort carriers. It wasn't designed to escort carriers. So it continues to be hit. It needs to be hit. So good people, keep thinking about ways that we can at least utilize this in some way to add more value than average, or design changes can be made, or it won't be sent to do things to get sailors killed unnecessarily. And the thing about Bob Work, I think he's a very enthusiastic advocate. He's a great patriot. He really wants to do the right thing. But, you know, very smart people, great patriots, I think, can be wrong and can make bad decisions. A couple of years ago, you know, he kind of came out and with a hearty laugh said he enjoyed John Patch's article. We've talked about this before. But he just kind of dismissed the argument. And he went on a sidebar about how we don't need frigates. Oh, well,
yeah,
I'm
there,
sorry.
There,
everything
there
I've seen last year. Yeah, we need frigates. And it's not a frigate. It can't function as a frigate. The bloody thing can't even defend itself. And in the initial core, I hate to sound like Salamander Nominus here, but darn it, years ago, the math was clear that you have got to have, if you really want to do this, as they're saying about swapping mission modules and crews out, you're going to have a lot more modules, or what you're going to have, you're going to have certain LCSs that have mission modules bolted to the deck to the point that the bolts are going to rust in. They're never going to be moved because there just aren't going to be that many mission modules out there. And that's the direction we're going in.
Well, I mean, part of the picture you see is that they're going to, that modules can stay deployed, and the ships can come back and do their normal cycle, I guess. So, I mean, some of that there is, I can make an argument you could do that. Let me go on to the other part of that budget hearing, which had to do with the Secretary of the Navy getting pinged on, particularly by, oddly enough, Republicans from Texas. They might have a slightly
I know where you're going.
Oil and petroleum, but they're pounding on him about spending $600 million on algae-based fuels and, you know, biofuel stuff. And, of course, he's sitting there taking it because I think he has orders from somebody else to keep pushing this this algae fuel thing. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. A little over a month ago when I put up a post about it, and this was before I completely lost faith with the SECNAV, which I did over the Gabby Giffords thing. I was a supporter of his. I gave him the benefit of the doubt. He lost me a couple of weeks ago. And I know a lot of people will sit me, I told you so. Yeah, whatever. I'm wrong occasionally. But my opinion of the SECNAV has changed. Again, one of those people, I don't think he's malicious or bad. I just think he's dangerously wrong in this respect. But when I did that article about the cost of the fuels a month or so ago, a couple people got in contact with me. I thought just one, and then another guy did, who are relatively close to understanding where the SECNAV comes on this. And this is actually something very personal for the SECNAV, which is dangerous when people let the personal affect their professional decisions. He really believes that we need to find some way to be more independent, that a Navy that relies on fossil fuels, if those fossil fuels disappear, then your Navy's ability to operate disappears. And he feels that that if the Navy makes a big investment in green energy, then it will create a critical mass, and that industry will help, quote, create, unquote, an industry right out of central planning bullshit from the red side of the house.
Well, and he has a five-year plan.
Yeah, a five-year plan. Have commissar. But he's a true believer in this. Unfortunately, what he's doing, and anybody in the Navy, there are twitchy people all over the place who have had, this is my budget for this quarter. Here is my fuel budget. And, okay, we're going to go 13.2 knots, not 15.5, because this is how much fuel I'm allowed to have. Or, you know what, I know we need to get that pilot more training hours, but because he's a little weak in the pattern, but you know what, we need to save gas till the end of the month, and then maybe we'll get it. And because of that, that pilot does a stupid mistake and kills himself and his wingman. So it has a real cost. And if you're buying fuel at four times the market price when you are in a budgetary crunch, you're insane. It is fiscal insanity to do that and to force an organization to do that because it's your pet project and your theory. Fuel is experience. And I don't think anybody is arguing that our officers have too much time on the bridge driving ships, that our pilots have too many flight hours. A matter of fact, all the evidence is to the contrary. And to spend what little money we have on fuel, and I know, well, it's taken from a different bucket of goo. Well, you know what? That little bucket of goo sits inside a larger bucket of goo called the defense budget. If you're taking $10 million from here, you're taking it from somebody else. And I think when a new Secretary of the Navy comes along, that this program will be allowed to gracefully fade into the distance.
Well, here you go. I'm going to throw another thing at you here where Ken Adams...
Pick on Salamander Day.
I'm going to pick on Salamander. This is free for all, and you're the fall. He posits a situation in which China takes steps to completely secure the South China Sea and doesn't let anybody go through there. And we have one ship and one aircraft carrier. What'd you say here, Ken? The five remaining ships of the 7th Fleet, George Washington, a Flight 2A Alpha Burke, and 3 LCS. go solve the problem. So what are we going to do? What's the plan? You get all that?
Have they sunk everything else? Or has not a shot been fired yet?
I think they just... declared an exclusion zone and sent the Chinese, the People's Liberation Army Navy out there, and we've got whatever's left
If China decides that it wants to have the South China Sea, and for its resources, and as long as they are letting merchant ships and commerce pass as they wish, they haven't attacked us. They haven't attacked our allies, not allies in theories, but allies like with a signature on a piece of paper. And those are the only forces we have. Is the South China Sea worth a general war with China?
Well, here
my
you
recommendation
go.
Is no. It's not.
Mr. Clark has come up with an answer. He says interdict all oil going into China through the Strait of Hormuz.
No. Now, my take is if they want the South China Sea, that is Vietnam's problem as the Philippines' problems. As long as they're letting market goods flow at market prices through that area of land, and it's not directly threatening the American interest or the interest of our allies, and don't give me this indirectly threat crap, it's not worth going to war with one-fifth of the world's population. It's not. If they really, 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 really want it that bad, do we let them have it, or do we risk going to war with 1.2 billion people in a country as deeply in debt as ours is? That's insanity. You let them have it; it's theirs. That's my take. It's not worth going to war over. Now, if they attacked us, there are other things I would do to make sure that the red flag of China is not seen on the high seas. And we could do that very quickly and very effectively. But that's only after they started a war with us, and they haven't at this point under this scenario.
Yeah, I don't find it that simple, because I suspect, in fact, I know that we have various treaty obligations to people like the Philippines and some other countries in the area that's going to force us to kind of go in and lend a hand to them in protecting their own territorial waters.
If the Chinese are smart, though, which they are, they haven't had a continuous culture for 5,000 years. Through fits and starts, because they're a dumb culture. The Chinese are smart, though. They're not going to draw blood against the Philippines. Now, they might draw a war against Vietnam. We don't have a treaty against Vietnam, though the Vietnamese probably would love to have a treaty with us. They're not going to pick a fight with the Australians. The Australians is too resource-rich in all the things, well, many of the things that China needs for their economy. For them to take the Spratlys It would have to be because something else in the world has caused them to do that, that makes them feel threatened, that they need to get that access. I mean, the Chinese have done a very good job in Africa and the Middle East of, through hook, crook, and bribery, getting access to the resources they need in order to support their economy, to make sure that the highest priority for China, which is internal stability, is maintained. As long as they feel secure in their access to resources, the Chinese are not going to want to go to war. Going to war is bad for business. They really have no territorial desires besides some theoretical ones in eastern Siberia, the Spratly Islands, South China Sea. But there has to be a spark that makes it worth going to war to get.
Yeah, their interest in the South China Sea, it seems to me, is mostly driven by the potential for energy resources, the potential for whatever else is under the sea that they might want to put into their Great East Asian economics prosperity sphere, whatever the
Greater East Asian co-prosperity. Wait, that was a Japanese. You know what I mean?
That was Japanese. Yeah, you know that if it's going to be, as long as they get what they need, and I don't think they're, I mean, I think they're smart. They're not crazy paranoid.
Yeah.
As long as they can get whatever they need to keep their economy going, you know, I don't think most of what we hear is kind of laying the foundation for what. You know, what they will claim if things go south on their economy and if there's a huge petroleum strike under the Spratlys and all that. Now, we're going to be testing that pretty soon. There's a lot of offshore drilling going on off Vietnam. There's a lot of offshore drilling going off, obviously, off Brunei and down Malaysia and, you know, the north west corner of Australia. So those areas are developing, and we may see this tested, probably not, you know, in the immediate future, but it is one of those questions.
Eagle One, back in the day, you've been to Hong Kong and have bought a suit, haven't you?
Yep.
Then you have a feel for how they do business in that culture. There'll be lots of noise. There'll be lots of posturing. But at the end of the day, if there is a huge resource out there, they're going to bargain their way, maybe bully and bluff their way. But I'm ready to be proved wrong. And if I would read the newspaper in the morning, I might be one day. I don't see that happening. I just don't. Now, where I potentially do see China going to war again, are places that we have no place being involved in. That's Western China and Tibet, with the unrest growing there. The Chinese, though, they've changed the truth on the ground demographics-wise, that there are enough Han Chinese and Tibet and Eastern Turkestan, if depending on how politically correct you are, which, by the way, I would recommend to everybody, Hopkirk has a couple of great books out there. He's the author of The Great Game. But he also has some great books out there that cover what is now Western China and Tibet from about 1850 to 1950. If you really want to educate yourself about that, it's a good thing to do. Great book.
You know, the other thing that may help us with China, this whole industry of horizontal drilling. I mean, I'm an old oil company lawyer, so I get off on oil company things. But this fracking and horizontal drilling. Apparently, there are some discoveries in China, or at least some preliminary indications in China, that they have much more in the way of resources than they had thought they could get to, and we may see, as we talked about with the woman we had from Rice University on, we may see that in countries, you know, like China and Poland and some of these other places, there's going to be a revolution in the technology. The revolution in the technology is going to free up a lot of the concerns about where the future energy is going to come from.
And we're already seeing the results of fracking here in the U.S. too, which is huge, not just for us, but global in energy environment, is it gives us a few more decades of bridging to let our technology go forward. It's not quite Moore's Law or anything, but energy efficiency and what technology has the potential to do for alternative energy every year gets better. If you can avoid either a negative economic impact due to excessive access to energy per kilowatt hour, if you can push that to the right a few more decades to let continuous advancement take place, it really has great things to do for the global economy and not just our economy. And all you got to do is look back to, you got two houses next to each other. They're both 2,500 square feet. One was built in 1971. The other one was built in, 2011. The electric bills are just ridiculously different between the two. I think it's really great news. There's some scaremongering about fracking, but it kind of reminds me of the China syndrome. A little bit of fact, a lot of mythology. But then again, the movie The China Syndrome was pretty effective on getting rid of our nuclear power, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Speaking of which, why aren't we more nuclear power? We've got nuclear-powered submarines, we've got nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. Why aren't we looking at nuclear-powered cruisers and even DDGs?
Is this 1952? What's going on here?
Admiral
Rickover, thank you. We have our guest today, Admiral Rickover.
I was channeling old Jaime.
Yeah, well, I think part of the problem is all the liberty sponges would suck all the fun out of pulling into Suda Bay. Because could you imagine a fleet full of surface nukes? That's just uncalled for.
I can imagine that, actually.
Well, good question. Why don't? Now, I'm gonna say something to you that sounds pretty weird, but I'm not medicated, so I tend to think darkly on occasion. Imagine, picture if you will, a warship is actually a pretty darn fragile thing, even an aircraft carrier. Submarines even more so. What if there was a almost Russian-like nuclear accident and leak in one of our bases in New England, Norfolk, Hawaii, worse yet, an overseas port, and all of a sudden people was like, no nuclear-powered ships are allowed inside our territorial waters. That's a weird thing. But going back to your question, that's a potential negative having a lot of new ships. I think the real negative reason is just the cost. The cost to maintain it. The effort to bring a nuclear carrier permanently to Jacksonville, which has gone away, and they're going to throw some amphibs instead as a bridging mechanism. Hundreds of millions of dollars just to have the infrastructure in place to be able to do basic maintenance. Not even overhaul work here. So that's a problem. I think it's the cost, a nuclear frigate. Imagine, striking a bottom mine in a nuclear frigate and it just cracks right up there. Combination of cost and a little bit of mitigation. I think the first major accident that we have with a nuclear reactor in a port somewhere, and the whole geometry is going to change on the utility of nuclear-powered vessels.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I keep thinking that given the amount of technology which should have developed over the last 50 to 60 years since 1952, when Admiral Hiram Rickover was – Hiram, that's right – Hyman, there we go. Obviously, I'm not a nuke. I do play one on television. The technology is advanced enough. I mean, there are talks now about Toshiba or some of these other companies making these like mini reactors that can be buried in the ground and used to power cities, neighborhoods. Nome, Alaska could get one of these things. They're almost autonomous. I can't help but believe there's got to be some technology that would help us develop a simpler and extremely safe reactor that could be used to provide the capability that we would need for the ships. Now, I have the other question, which is at least with the gas turbines, they're almost instantaneous and in operation, kind of like any kind of jet. But the reactor ships would be steam, and I wonder if that's an issue that steam is just so dangerous to play with.
Yeah, you mentioned there was a great article I read a few years ago that was talking about the designs for small nuclear reactors that can power a few hundred homes equivalent. But for remote, they were looking mostly for a moon base. It's a great design for a moon base or for a large space station that we're all promised to have by 2001 that never came into existence. But there are smaller nuclear reactors that are extremely safe design that could be used. I would be more interested, and I had a nuclear engineer explain to me the new commercial designs, and kind of excited about they're going to allow new civilian reactors to come online because the new designs are just different. It's the difference between an engine and a 1957 Dodge, and you open up the hood of a brand new Ford Mustang. You know, they're just completely different, a lot safer, a lot more reliable. And I think that's what's going to really be exciting, these new nuclear power plants we have coming online in the civilian sector. And we have plenty of coal in this country, but it's good to have a diverse network to power your country. I know those in the Northeast would like their grid updated, but that's an electrical engineering problem I don't really understand. I've just been told it's put together with baling wire and duct tape, which I think we've been very lucky that our enemies, the terrorists, they have more medical doctors in their leadership than electrical engineers.
Yeah, Paul on the chat room points out there is a new design reactor that Bill Gates has been putting some money in. It's called a wave reactor. I've been looking into it recently. The claim is that they can take all the depleted uranium that we have gathered around in various places and use that stuff to run these reactors, and we would then have enough just from using the depleted stuff we already have on hand. I think it's like 250 years worth of operation of these reactors. Have you heard anything about those?
Yeah, I've just seen oblique mentions of them, but that's about it. I think the biggest problem to getting these things approved is getting it through the bloody EPA. Or if you're trying to get Canadian oil down to our friends to the south, having the State Department nuke it. Oh, God, what an abomination. Next Canadian I see, I'm going to apologize to him. I just realized, though, that our free-for-all is about to come to a screeching halt in 2 minutes. Let me look in the okay, guys, in the chat room. Throw me your question.
You've been a great guest.
Hey, like I said, I have a chatty Kathy. Who can I pick on here? I'd like to pick on Claude, but he's been a good boy here. Come on, Lee. You always have a question here. Pop me a question. Speak now or forever hold your peace. Let's see, I had some stuff written down here. Well, if nobody else is going to talk for the last 2 minutes, and I know that we got BJ in the audience, I talked to a couple people this week about something that's near and dear to our house, blogging and writing and opinions on national security issues. There's a group of people out there that have a huge totalitarian instinct to narrow the scope of acceptable recourse. And I would just like to tell them to bite me. Let there be more conversation and more speaking. And we've all seen it in the online world and in the offline world. Even in a great country as ours, there are people that are trying to stop free discussion. It's absolutely shocking. But, hey, when you have barriers to entry of a cost of zero, Eagle One, I guess we'll be able to keep chatting in every way we want to. Eagle One? They got to him at last.
Claude Barraby, future of Gulf of Guinea security ops. That's a topic for another show, Claude.
Claude, you want to talk about the Gulf of Guinea? Give me a Gulf of Guinea expert. All I know is you're free to go to Africa. You can have that continent. I don't want to do anything near it. No shore duty there. And on that note, I want to thank everybody who came for the free-for-all here. And join us again next week. We're going to have a live version of Midrats. And keep an eye open for the show advertisements. And Lee, I have no idea what a global square is. Send me an email. We'll talk later. Everybody have a great Navy Day.
Thank you all for showing up.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy Old, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly.
It's a long way to Tipperary.